You can think of plateaus as you're spending a couple weeks, it just seems like you're getting the same scores. You aren't improving the way you would like to be.
Because plateauing and burnout can really coincide.
Just dial back a little bit. That can be the best remedy for any sort of burnout or plateau. All right, welcome back to the Seven Sage Podcast. We are your hosts for this season. I'm Bailey Luber.
I'm Alex Jacobs.
Henry Ewing here.
Nice. And we're going to talk about something super fun today that everybody seems to want to talk a lot about, score plateaus. But before we get into that, we're definitely going to have to spend some time defining it, talking through how to get out of one. I want to hear a little bit about your guys' weeks. Alex, what was the highlight of your teaching week? We all teach live classes here at Seven Sage. I don't know. Anything fun happen?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying my comparative passages class. I feel like there's just kind of the kind of Seven Sage method for comparative passages tends to unlock things for people. So it's fun. It's kind of like the closest. People often want a quick fix in the LSAT, and we all know that's very hard. But there's something about the comparative class passage strategy that it's like a pretty quick fix as LSAT fixes go. So it's kind of fun to do that and have new people come every week and be like, oh, yeah, this is something like actually the closest thing to a silver bullet that I can provide. It's been going well.
If you're wondering what that strategy is, it's locked behind the Seven Sage paywall.
Right.
You should subscribe to Seven Sage, right? Exactly.
No, we'll get to it. We'll do an episode about it.
We should definitely do an episode on that. I don't know. I think highlight of my weeks, some of my in-person classes have been a lot more based on conditional reasoning, sufficient assumption, necessary assumption. If you're interested in taking an in-person class in New York, we'll be offering those over the summer and some intensives in the meantime. I really like talking about sufficient assumption and necessary assumption. I think as far as quick fixes go with sufficient assumption and necessary assumption, I wouldn't call them quick fixes, but it's one of those things where once they click, they become very, very easy compared to how they once were. Once you understand the concept of like negation or premise to conclusion gaps, you just start seeing them all the time. And it's really hard to miss those questions once you see that gap. But it takes a lot of practice to get there. And so I like in my in-person classes, we've been working a lot more on that. It's been a blast. It's been a hoot. In-person classes are quite fun. I don't know. I like them. Yeah. I like the online classes too. It's all great. Teaching's fun.
Totally. Speaking of, Bailey and I are teaching some LA classes in person. Bailey's teaching a West LA class. I'm teaching one on the East Side. And then we're splitting a class in Orange County. So if you live in the Southland, in Southern California, you've got plenty of options coming up this summer. Bailey, what was your highlight of the week?
Thank you for bringing it back to me. I had a lot of fun on Thursday. I did like a really long, 11-hour day, I think. I took all your classes because you're out of town. You. Thank you. No, it was really fun. I realized my highlight of last week was I was given two opportunities to bring back my fully splitting game boards class. It's a logic games class that I used to do weekly that we're just going to fill in whenever we can now. Maybe bring it back on the schedule. I don't know. I want to. But we just work on fully splitting. And again, on that theme of the quick fixes for the LSAT, it's not necessarily going to be a quick fix. But once you learn how to split, once you learn how to get a finite number of game boards, that'll help you understand the different families or scenarios that this game can take on. Everything feels so much more clear, so much nicer and easier for logic games.
Universal theme, our classes make the LSAT easier.
Right, exactly. Oh, wow. Yeah, there's a takeaway.
Novel concept, yeah, crazy.
And if you're wondering what we're talking about, like, if you're not a subscriber, we all teach live classes, so that's through the Seven Sage Live subscription. That's what we're referring to here. So, come check it out. Another thing we want to do is just plug our email address, podcast@sevensage.com. We want to start featuring listener questions. So if you have questions, please reach out and we'll be, picking, we'll see how that unfolds, but we want to start featuring them pretty regularly and answering questions that you have. So podcast@sevensage.com. All right. Should we get into what we're talking about today?
Well, I'm actually curious to know what Henry thinks about this. How would you define a plateau? People always talk about I'm plateauing on the LSAT. How do I get out of my plateau? What are they talking about? What should they be talking about?
It's a great question, Bailey. Yeah.
Let's
so plateau.
Terms.
Yeah. Plateau. Right. So a flat thing. Is that what plateau is?
I think it literally is. Yeah.
Is it a hill? Geographic feature.
I think it requires a hill on both sides.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Like okay, a hill maybe. Into a flat part.
Okay. I picture like fair mountain, well, but chopped off the top. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. At the very least, on the LSAT, what is a plateau? A plateau is where you are stuck at a particular score for a extended period of time. I wouldn't really define a plateau by a time frame. I would just say probably like longer than a week or two. It's hard to say what a plateau is, right? Because like there's some extent of where you plateau and you're, oh, I'm plateauing at the low 170s. I mean, is that really a plateau? It might take a couple months to go from like a 171 average to a 173 average. So I don't know if that I would fully call that a plateau. I mean, you should be seeing a little bit of progress, but as you get higher up, the progress gets slower. Totally. But I do think like if you're in the 140s through like the high 160s, this is where you can think of plateaus as you're spending a couple weeks. It just seems like you're getting the same scores. You aren't improving the way you would like to be. Right, the improvement rate is either non-existent or very, very minute. That's probably where I would say a plateau. Usually, if you kind of know when you're plateauing. Do we really need to define it? Right.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say maybe it's really clear for you at this point what plateaus are. But when we were putting together this episode, we were thinking, I mean, there's plenty of students that come in and they're like, I'm plateauing. I'm freaking out. I'm like, wait, you're not really plateauing, though. What do you mean? You just got the same PT score twice. And actually one of them had like a lot higher of an LG score and you're a lot lower of an RC score. Something like sections were flopped. Like there's differences.
Yeah.
So how did we?
That's a great point.
Yeah. What
were you saying? If you get the same score several weeks in a row, but your like raw scores are like all over the place, you know, it's not quite a plateau in the same way. There's different types of plateaus, right? The other thing I think that's important is just how long have you been studying, right? If you've been studying for a month and you find your scores stagnant, like I don't think you can say that that is yet a plateau, right? So I think the like basic definition that we sort of talked about was like, finish the core curriculum, studying at least 3 months, PTing 1 or 2 months, and you know you're getting three PTs within a few points of each other. And so I think just as important as just what's not a plateau, if you just started studying, right? Like you know these are sort of growing pains. It's something that you should sort of push through. If you haven't exhausted the core curriculum, like don't stress. Like this is just a very normal part of the process. And I would not necessarily, I think your best friend is just going to be completing everything that you have yet to complete. So this, when we talk about plateaus, it's really for people who've completed the core curriculum, feel like, okay, I don't have any, or there aren't obvious tools for me to turn to now. I've seemingly exhausted the resources that are available to me. So what do I do? You know, so I think that's sort of the differentiation that we wanted to get across for what's a plateau versus kind of just normal, you know, the right. Beginning of the progress. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when I think of a plateau too, right? Like I'm usually thinking of like a PT plateau, right? You're getting the same score on a PT.
Yeah.
And usually you're not taking too many in an ideal study plan, I would say, right? If you're fresh, you're not taking many PTs because guess what? Those PTs are probably just going to say you're bad at everything.
Right.
I don't say, what's the point? There's some timing ideas and at least getting used to this idea of doing multiple problems at once. But really early on, you need to focus on the fundamental concepts, right? So if you spend a week studying, it's your first week, you get a 145 and then you get a 146. You're not plateauing, mostly just because you have no studying under your belt. This might be a little bit different, though. I mean, I want to say for the few people who might be score pretty well or do pretty well early on, then a plateau is going to be more of like a function of like how you're scoring as opposed to how long you've spent studying. I mean, obviously these things are correlated with one another, but you know, if you're a month into studying and you're just consistently getting 170s, I might be comfortable calling that closer to a plateau as opposed to someone who's a month into studying consistently getting 150s. Just means there's a lot. There's a lot to work on there. Until you take a lot of PTs and you're pretty familiar with all the core curriculum, you can get let's just take someone who gets a 170, right? Someone who gets a 170 and misses 9 in LR but goes perfect on LG and RC, And then the next week, they miss 0 on LR, but they miss 9 on RC and LG. That's not really a plateau, because it just means that you have you're deficient, right, on both LR and LG, and it's just being masked. And the reason it's being masked is that any given test is not going to test for every single skill you have to know on this test. Right? If you just look at the distribution of LR questions, yeah, there's an average, right? You're probably going to see around 4, a little bit over 4 on a necessary assumption questions. But maybe you see only one necessary assumption on a particular section. Well, if you're really bad at necessary assumption questions, right, you might have an inflated score on that particular PT. And then the next PT, you mess up all 4 of those necessary assumption questions, but you have an inflated RC score, right? So you do have to check out the individual sections too. I don't know why I'm saying this, but just to mention, right, you should be scoring relatively the same across all sections for you to really be thinking, I'm in a plateau area.
Totally.
Or in any individual section, not across all 3. That's a better way. Any section should have the same score level.
Yeah, but I think the utility of this episode in particular is sort of for people who've been studying a bit, finding these scores sort of stuck, and who are sort of like, what do I do? Like, I've finished the core curriculum. Like, I've tried different study techniques. I've been at this a while. Maybe it's 3 months. Maybe it's a year. You know, and it's just like, what is there left for me? First things first. I mean, it's like, might sound trite, might sound like a cop out, but it's like, this is very normal. And the first thing is to realize that this happens to a lot of people, probably the majority of people. And so to keep pushing, to not feel like, and to know, like, there are ways through this. There are things that we're going to share with you today that can help you through it. Like, it's that sort of hitting a wall that can really lead you to kind of give up. And it's just important to know, like, there are ways through this. What occurs to you, Bailey, when someone comes to you with a problem like this?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I have a very similar approach. The very first thing that we want to talk about is like, okay, number one, you are not alone. I had so many situations in the LSAT when I was scoring plateau, I was in a scoring plateau, or I was, you know, seeing a lot of variation between my scores. I'm like, am I the only person in the whole world that's experiencing this? Because this test is so frustrating. And no, that was never, ever the case. As soon as I started teaching it, I was like, oh my God, this is hilarious. Everybody goes through a very similar process in lots of different orders, in lots of different ways that it shows up. But trust me, other people are there. And the other thing too is that, of course, you know, as you get better at this test, you're going to realize that you have more potential to improve on what you're doing. And so you're going to put more pressure on yourself to get there. And that, although it's hard to flip off that switch, is very counterintuitive. You just want to remind yourself, this isn't helpful. Like, as I realize that I'm better at this test, is it really helpful for me to then put that X amount more pressure on myself and say, hey, you need to get this score or else, whatever that is that you're doing in your own brain? Like, it's not helpful. And so a lot of times also we talked about these plateaus being more of a product of your built up anxiety, whether or not you think that you have testing anxiety for this test, things like that. A lot of it is natural, a lot of it's normal, but a lot more of it is in your head than you normally think. So
Bailey Luber, it's all in your head.
Yeah, get over it.
See, that's what scared me, though, because then I'm like, well, right, but it's in my head, but I have control over my head, but what if the thing has control over me? But trust me, you have control.
We can't
you
go
are
down
fine.
This loop. Yeah, you do. I think it's important to note that, like, the gains slow down. Like, that there's, like, that initial, you know, the diagnostic is always scary, and then, you know, you can feel like, oh, wow, I'm, like, progressing in so many ways because you're learning a new skill. And, like, for me, I don't know about for you guys, but it's, like, it's always exciting to, like, learn something new. Like, the rush of, like, oh, wow, I'm progressing at this quickly because I'm starting from zero. And so it can feel like that, you know, that's sort of like, oh, I'm watching it go up however much. And then when it slows down, it can be scary. It does slow down. It has to, right? The gains get harder the higher up you get. So also important to recognize the progress that has gotten you to this plateau. You know, because you can feel like, oh my gosh, I'm stuck. Oh my gosh, I'm bad at this. I'm doing something wrong. Like, always take a moment to reflect on all of the work you've done up until this point and all the progress you've made. And that progress hasn't ended. You're still in the middle of that progress. It's still happening. What about you, Henry? What recommendations do you have when people come to you?
Well, my clients and students never plateau. But if they were to, right, if they were to.
Yeah.
No, plateauing is part of the process. So if you plateau, it's not that you're stuck. You're actually moving forward. That's what mm-hmm. I usually say, right? Is that like yeah. you're probably, most people plateau. When you do plateau, it just means that you are progressing. Studying many things in life is just a revolving door, right? So it's like, oh, it looks, I'm going down, but you have to go down to go up, right? Same concept there, is that like part of going from 140 to a 170 is probably plateauing at some point. Why would you expect to not plateau? Almost everyone does. it's the same thing I say when people take a test and they, oh my God, I had technical problems. Like, yeah, it's frustrating, but it's also like, just expect that you're going to have some sort of technical problem yeah. when you're taking the test right. online. In the same way, when you're studying, just expect that you're going to have some sort of plateau. It sucks when it happens, but it's also just part of it. And so you're really making forward progress when you do hit that plateau.
Universalizing problems on the LSAT is really useful too, because you have to realize like you are being scored directly compared to other people. Like it is a curve, you know? And so like people are experiencing technical difficulties across the board. That is factored into the curve. Like if you experience technical difficulties, just know that other people are as well. You know, not to get into like how the curve works, but just know that it's like, it's very rare that someone comes with a problem that is totally unique to them. Not that you aren't all unique, wonderful people.
Yeah, every person is unique, but every problem is a cookie cutter.
Yeah, garden variety, just whatever. But let's get into some tangible tips. Maybe we can go through some scoring range, you know, what we would do if we were plateauing in the 140s, 150s, you know, sort of break it down that way. I guess a big thing for me, just a little spoiler, is that no matter where you are, I think you have room to go back to the fundamentals. Maybe it doesn't occur to you the higher you are, but I find a lot of times it's like, do not be a, people are a little bit afraid to backtrack. They think like, I'm stuck here, so I already know conditional logic. I already know argument structure. So like, there must be something else that I just don't know. Most people don't know these concepts as well as they could, because it takes their hard concepts. And so there's always more to mine there. So my big piece of advice to people is always don't be afraid to go back. Don't be afraid to review the building blocks. To me, that's usually the ones that occur to me are argument structure. You know, am I really identifying premise and conclusion? Am I really focusing on the conclusion on an argument-based question? And conditional logic. I don't know, Henry, you deal with a lot of conditional logic. Is that something that you see in people who plateaued? Room there to improve?
Yeah. I mean, I if we're going to go just based on like score brackets, I know we have the 140s first, but I'd say like conditional logic is something that people like would plateau on, maybe in the 150s, high 150s, 160s. And usually when they're plateauing, right, I look at someone who says they're good at must be true questions. Or they know how to do must be true questions, but they diagram everything out. They look at a conditional. They group three or group four, X, Y, and Z. I know how to translate this. I don't need to work on that anymore. At least going back to the fundamentals, I say, well, you're actually not good enough at the fundamentals, right? If you look at a phrase that's not unless and you think negate sufficient, you need to not even do that. Right, you need to do a lot of conditional translations to just look at a sentence and know automatically what the sufficient condition is and what the necessary condition is. That's talking about the fundamentals. And so the goal, right, or at least my goal with someone who – it seems like they do well on conditional logic. Are they taking a lot of time to do it?
Yeah.
If the answer is yes – that's a huge indication that maybe instead of studying must be true, you conceptually know how to do must be true questions. You conceptually know how to do sufficient assumption, PSA questions. But you don't actually know the fundamentals enough. You cannot think about translating things. You just have to know what a translation is of a particular sentence. If that's not you, you're plateauing in the 160s. Go back to the drawing board, right? Work on your conditional translations. Work on just knowing what a sentence translates to without having to think it out. The example I always go for is just like, you don't look at the color red by pulling up the color wheel, right? And saying like, well, is it green? No, it's not green. Oh, is it yellow? It's not yellow. Oh, okay, this is red. Now you look at red and you just know what it is. A similar principle needs to apply with conditional statements, right? You have to look at it, know what the sufficient condition is, know what the necessary condition is. You have to already, this phrase, take the contrapositive comes up a lot. There's no taking of the contrapositive, right? The contrapositive is just another way to write the conditional, right? We say take the contrapositive to get you started, right? If you have no idea, if you're new to understand how it works, but ultimately, in an ideal world, you should look at a conditional and know what it translates to just automatically, right? So if you're hitting a score plateau in the 160s and it looks like you're doing well on must be true question, what I would recommend to you is like look for ways you can make your must be true questions or sufficient assumption questions a little bit more efficient, and that's going to free up a lot of mental energy for you on other problems, weakening problems, strengthening problems, because conditionals are they're difficult up front, but then there's a click that happens and they're not so difficult. That could open up a lot of like mental energy for you, right? You should not be expending brain power on conditional translations. If you're new, right? if you're in the 140s, at least when it comes to conditional translations, I mean, I don't want to say there's no plateauing in the 140s. There definitely is, but I can almost guarantee if you're in the 140s, you don't know your conditional translations enough, right? So again, you need to start focusing a little bit more on that, understanding if-then statements, just drilling those out. Feel free to diagram that out so you can kind of track the argument better. So that's going to be a little bit different between the two different scores, right? If you're in the 150s, maybe the 160s, work on translating in your head faster. If you're in the 140s, you're plateauing, you feel like you're not so good at conditional arguments, just I would actually recommend diagramming, right? Diagram everything out so you can just begin to parse how arguments work. But yeah, I mean, that's what I would say in terms of like conditional plateauing. A lot of it just comes down to translation. I mean, because the secret is like after you get the basic concept of what a conditional does, a sufficient condition and a necessary condition, if apple, then fruit. That's really all there is to this test, right? Is like apple, then fruit. It's actually not too complicated. What is complicated is the translations, right? So getting faster, more efficient at translations.
Right.
I don't know if that resonates with you guys. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, totally agree.
Definitely. Yeah. I think, go ahead, Bailey.
Real quick, I was just going to make a parallel to learning a new language as well. Like if you're still in that phase of, you know, having to translate whatever you hear in a different language into your own language in your head, and then it makes sense, and then you have to retranslate what you want to say back into the other language, like that's, you know, taking a long time. That's when you think that you're fluent at a language, but you're not actually fluent. Like we got to get to the point of fluency on this test. How do we get there? We stop making all of those steps to translate. It doesn't mean that you're ever cutting corners. You're going to keep doing those steps to translate. And then as you get better and better at them, they just fall away. You don't have to rely on each rigid step anymore.
Yeah. I think language is a good analogy. I talk about sports a lot. Like for this, you know, when you're learning a sport, if you're learning to play basketball, you're really thinking about these things. You're thinking about how to dribble. Of course, if you are trying to improve at basketball, you want to get to a point where you're not thinking about that. And it takes a long time. I don't think anyone would assume that they're going to master basketball in a month. And, you know, the LSAT is masterable. It just, it can take a lot of time. So yeah, sort of actionable steps. I think in the 140s, there's like conceptual room to grow. I would say, like, you know, really be honest about this. I think, like I talked about at the beginning, I see people who are a little bit hesitant to backtrack. Be honest about your areas for growth, your opportunities for growth. With conditionals, do I really understand these backwards and forwards? Like Henry says, does a contrapositive just occur to me naturally? Because it is just one's the other side of the coin. They're not two different ideas. It's really contained within one idea. But don't be afraid to go back to the core curriculum. Bailey, does anything occur to you for argument structure for people in the 140s?
Yeah, that's the other thing I was going to touch on. If you're not consistently for every single LR question at the very least, then we can talk about applying this to RC, identifying what's a premise, what's the conclusion. At the very least, be able to pick out what is the main conclusion in the argument. Like that was something that I kind of scraped by on for the longest time. It definitely led to a plateau later on. I don't even remember like what score range I was in, but at some point I was like, all right, what's the deal here? Like I'm, you know, getting the gist of this stimulus and then I'm going to the question, I'm getting it wrong still. Like what am I missing? then when I dialed back and I realized, oh, I just wasn't confident in what I was identifying as a premise and conclusion, or I mm-hmm. wasn't always right in what I was identifying. Yeah. That definitely helps. So, like, my
what was the fix there for you?
That's what I was going to say. My fix is that I'd pull out some sentences that I'm always going to ask myself every single time to make sure that it's actually a conclusion. So first test is, do I have reason to believe this? I just ask myself, okay, if I'm thinking that something has conclusion vibes, can I point to a reason to believe this somewhere else in the stimulus? If there's no reason that I'm supposed to believe this, however bad the reason, can't be a conclusion. If it passes that first test, right. then it's a conclusion. Could still be subconclusion, could still be main conclusion. What's a subconclusion? It lends right. support to a main conclusion. I want to find that mic drop, end all be all, main conclusion statement. How I find that is I ask myself, does this thing that just passed my first conclusion test lend itself to believe anything else in the argument? Ideally, I have another yeah. answer or another answer choice, another sentence that I'm pitting against it. I'm like, oh, you know, maybe this one is the conclusion. Maybe this one is. Well, does knowing this make me more likely to believe the other thing? If so, right. the other thing that's given reason to be believed by our potential conclusion is actually the main conclusion. So that's that. Two questions. Mm-hmm. Do I have reason to believe this? And does knowing this make anything else more likely to be true?
For yeah. me, I just do the why test.
Oh, yeah, that's good, too.
It's very similar
yeah.
to accomplishing the same thing. But I just say, if I have two things, I'm not sure what's the conclusion, what's the premise, I just say, I will say the conclusion first, say why is that true, and see if the premise answers that question in any way. And if so, then I've got it right. What about you, Henry?
Yeah, I was just going to say the why test works well, and you can also look for indicators too, but a lot yeah. of this comes down to this idea of the direction of support too. If you're really good, right, you can understand support is just making something more likely to be true, right? So you have two statements. The statue is scary, and another statement, the statue has a skull on it. Right? You ask yourself, well, which claim supports the other, right? The fact that the statue has a skull on it supports the claim that the statue is scary, but not really the other way around, right? Because it could be scary for a number of reasons. Maybe it's not a skull, but it looks like a monster. And so just understanding how support works can also be very helpful, right? This is what a reason to believe is, right? If a statement supports another statement, if a statue having a skull supports the idea that the statue is scary, the fact that the statue has a skull gives you a reason to believe that the statue is scary. And that can help mm-hmm. you unpack the way arguments are working without necessarily relying on indicators too.
And I think with all these things, you want to use these things in conjunction with one another. We don't want to only rely on one tool. That's true for argument parts. That's true for conditionals. And, you know, eventually I think you get to the place where, like, you don't even think about indicator words because you're so intuitively understanding these things that you don't need them, but use them until you realize that you're not using them. Like use them until you're to the point where you've just mastered it. And then you're just sort of intuitively seeing it. And it doesn't mean you don't ever use it, but it's not the first thing you turn to perhaps.
Right.
I mean, for me, like the name of the game is like fundamentals are what you need to focus on. It's just going to be in different ways, right? The lower scores, it's conceptual, and the higher scores, it's like efficiency and doing them automatically and making them something that's so intuitive to you. You can do it in your sleep. You know, it's like with the language metaphor, Bailey, I know like, or analogy, people talk about like, you know, you are really know a language when you start dreaming in that language.
Right.
I mean,
that's what I was gonna say.
It's with conditionals. It's like, you really know, you know, conditionals when you just start seeing them in the wild. And while that may not be good for you as a person,
like your mental
it
health.
Good
yeah.
For you,
no, but
for
as
you
soon as
as
I started
LSAT
seeing
taker.
It in advertisements, I'm like, oh, wait, yeah. there's so the conditionals. I used to think this was this weird, lofty concept that only existed in LSAT land. No, it exists in the entire world. It's like in the grains of our existence.
Absolutely. And okay, also, just to pivot, I do think it changes you as a person for the better. I mean, I know this can be a really frustrating test, but I do think learning these things pays dividends in just the way you see the world. And I think sometimes we discount that because it's like, yeah, this is annoying. Yeah, it's not really what you're going to be doing. Well, we can argue about that. It's not like literally what you're going to be doing in law school, but like there's a reason it's important, you know? So anyways,
no,
I feel like learning conditional logic at the extent that I have. Yeah, Bailey.
I have a good segue back from that. I think that's totally true. Mm-hmm. And even just this idea that we keep drilling in everybody's brains in the LSAT is slowing down in order to speed up. I've had so many students that are like, okay, as soon as I, you know, fully understood that, I started applying it to other parts of my life. And like, it's great, you know, slow down to speed up, slow down to have better conversations, relationships with people. I don't know. This girl was talking about how she actually slowed down when surfing in order to speed up and was able to get up a lot more times. That, where it's just like, okay, you have to do those counterintuitive things. So many life lessons in the LSAT, which that's what something we were mentioning you need to do for RC. Like, if you haven't tried that yet, what have you tried for RC?
Yeah.
Let's slow down. Let's read every single word on the page and make the next right decision.
And I mean, quickly too, on the surfing reference, it's like mine your other life experiences. Like, what has worked for you elsewhere and how can I apply that? Like, obviously, like, the technique you're going to use to surf is not going to help you on the LSAT, but like, what did you do? In a general sense, what was your learning process like? Can be really useful in other things that have been challenging for you and that have taken a lot of time. But yeah, as far as RC goes, I think really knowing you cannot rush through the reading part. I think that's just something that we probably all see a lot is people like, well, I'm not being scored on the actual reading of this, so I need to get to the part where I'm actually getting scored on. And there's just no hope of reaching your potential on any given passage if you don't really, really understand the passage to begin with. So I don't know, Henry, what techniques do you offer people on RC in this scenario?
Yeah, I mean, with RC, a lot of it is timing, reading every single thing. I mean, also just a bit of, I guess you're speaking on, like, is this useful for the real world? And just going back to, like, the motivations, which is that, one, why does it have to be useful for you to do it? Two, but really, like, if anything, the RC section is going to be probably testing the most skills you'll be using in law school. It's actually going to be testing your ability to understand something that you probably don't want to read. Plot twist. Not a whole lot of reading in law school is exciting. It's actually all pretty boring. A lot more boring than your average RC passage, right? So sometimes you just got to buckle down and say, guess what? I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes of my life like reading this passage in its entirety. I don't care about if it's boring. Oh, it's boring. Just remember that you're planning on going to law school where the next 3 years of your life will be reading for many, many, many more pages for something that's probably a little bit less interesting to you. And it's just going to be important that you buckle down and try to force yourself to comprehend it. So, yeah, plateauing in RC is hard. A lot of it is also, I mean, not to be the LR guy, but a lot of it comes down to LR. A lot of RC questions are either recognize what is stated, but also inference questions. And your ability to do well on most strong and supported questions, for example, and the better you are at most strong and supported question, is going to really help you on RC. These RC inference questions where, you know, what does the author think? And then everything will look good, except it slips in the word most or doesn't or always thinks X, Y, and Z. And then sometimes the solution is just to drill more LR, right?
But also don't forget about RC. Yeah. There's so many people. Myself included, I treated it like the forgotten child of the LSAT forever, and it didn't work. So I was stuck in a couple of plateaus for RC for a while. I had this one that I swore I was getting -8 every single time for who knows how long. And I was super annoyed. I was frustrated. I wanted to get past that. And again, you know, there's plenty of ways that you can just get better at the other two sections and maybe not have to get past that. But if you want to really maximize your chances for getting the best score that you possibly can in this task, you are going to get to the bottom of each of your problems. And so what worked for me, which I don't recommend to everybody because this is really one of those things where whatever works best for one person does not necessarily work best for the next. But I had a big breakthrough when I realized, hey, even with 35-minute sections, I had the time to read twice. Like, what worked for me was to go through, reconnect those neurons one quick time, maybe just a 30-second skim through the passage after I had already read it, or if my eyes are already glazing over first paragraph, I switch up, I do a skim through first, then I go back and read every word. Whatever it is that I need to do for that passage, that was like a big turning point for me because I just was always too scared to even try that.
Totally. I think active reading is a big thing that, and it's a hard thing to teach or develop. You know, there's a certain amount of it that's intuitive, but something that I've realized is like, you know, these can be boring. They can feel very rushed. And so you can kind of forget to just engage. And it's something that's really hard to sort of teach or develop. But something that I've started to do is with students is just ask them to read it and tell me every single question that occurs to them as it occurs to them, because that's really what you're doing when you're actively reading. And at first it's going to feel slow. And this is another thing with RC, you have to go slow before you can go fast, because whenever I'm teaching RC, a question that always comes up is like, well, this is all great, but how am I supposed to do this under time? And it goes back to all the things we've been talking about with conditional logic or playing sports or learning a language, like, you, until you learn it, it's not going to go fast, right? You need to go slow to develop these skills. So with active readings, reading it really slowly and just either voicing it, saying it aloud, saying it to another person if you have someone who's willing to engage in that with you. But, like, just because that's what you want to be doing. And so it's like saying every single question that occurs to you, no matter how small or big or smart or stupid it may seem, just every single question. And it's going to take you a long time, but the best active readers and the best version of you as a reader is going to be engaging with the text at that level. And it's going to get faster the more you do it. So that's something that I would throw out there too.
Yeah, well, I guess one final thing I mentioned, because I feel the need to talk and have the final word, is just this idea that one thing I also see a lot of people doing before, and we can universalize this a little bit, is that a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to understand why right answers are right, and ignore not only why wrong answers are wrong, or maybe you have some sort of intuitive idea about wrong answers being wrong, but looking for patterns in wrong answers. A lot of wrong answers in RC look the same, right? They use the same kind of terminology. The same is going to be true across different question types on LR. So spending some time just meticulously looking at wrong answers and looking for patterns in wrong answers can also be helpful. Right? If you get quicker at eliminating an answer choice, you see, I've seen this before. It's flipping the sufficient in the necessary condition. I don't even need to consider this. Your life is going to be a lot easier. So in the same vein with RC, like, look for patterns in wrong answers so you can be better at eliminating. I know with RC, more so than any other section, I get to a lot of answer choice by elimination rather than LR, where very frequently I'm hunting for the right answer. Or in LG, you're kind of hunting for the right answer.
And I think patterns in general, looking for patterns beyond just, oh, this is the same question type, or this is, like, getting down to the real nitty-gritty of, like, you know, and I think you can do that across every section. So sort of wrong answer journals, those sorts of things, really spending time with your wrong answers and seeing, identifying your own patterns beyond just those, oh yeah, I'm getting a lot of necessary assumption questions wrong. It's like, across question types, are you struggling with, you know, correlation causation, or, you know, just like looking for things that make an ideal experiment, or any number of things, right? Should we transition to LG? Bailey, you talk a lot about splitting game boards and those things. What's your first recommendation for people who are maybe plateauing in LG?
Yeah, and I was going to say that this is probably a good time to have that conversation. Is it even worth taking the conversation that is going to happen? Is it even worth taking this test with logic games? I have plenty of students asking this right now. So number one, if you want to get really good at logic games, yes, split your game boards. Honestly, we spent plenty of time last episode talking about that. So if you want to hear more, listen to that episode. Foolproof, foolproof, foolproof. If you're not familiar with that foolproof concept yet, it's just repeating a game until you get it down to a freaky fast amount of time and you're able, I mean, I say, until you're able to teach it to somebody else. Like, that's the level that you want to hold yourself to if you really want to get perfect at games, which you can. You totally can. But yeah, is it worth taking the test with logic games? Test is going away. I wish. No, I actually don't wish that. But logic games going away after June. Come August, there's going to be two LR sections, one RC section, another experimental that's one of the two. Have you actually tapped out with logic games? I mean, I don't think that you really know if you've tapped out until, I don't know, you've given it at least more than a month. You have tried a lot of different things. You've tried splitting game boards. You've tried not splitting game boards. You've, you know, asked the questions that you need to. You've gotten to the bottom of how to approach different questions. At the same time, you really just need to understand the game itself. This is all general advice. Anybody have anything more specific?
I guess also, I don't know what we think about this, but I would say you have about a month to make that decision.
I think so too.
If you decide you're not going to take it with LG, then you have till August. So that's great. You have plenty of time to focus on LR and RC. And, like, so you aren't wasting time if you spend the next month doing LG and then you decide not to do it with LG. Like, you still have plenty of time to prep for that August test. So I'd say about a month to make that determination. Does that seem right to you, Henry?
Yeah. I mean, here's my take on this. I'll take the hotter take. Why not? If you've just started studying, no, just take August. If you have been studying for a month, maybe you have you been progressing? Do you like logic games? the answer is yes, then you can keep going. I don't think it's that, it won't necessarily be to your detriment, but it's like the advantage of logic games is that like it can be a mental break if you're really good at them. If you think that you just might be all right at them, I don't think the benefit is that high, right? Like, there should be a pretty clear, from here, from when you start studying or wherever you're at, I think there should be a more or less clear pattern or clear path to you getting minus zero on LG for it to really be worth sinking time in. Studying LR is just so valuable right now, and it's really hard for me to recommend someone take the logic game section unless it really is a mental break for them, or there's a very clear path to getting a perfect score basically on it.
I think there are people who are way better at LG than other sections.
Well,
you know?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I was when I took the test. Yeah.
There are some people for whom, I mean, and I would say even people who may be towards the beginning, where it's like you actually like do way better at LG. And so I think, if you're plateauing, if you've been doing this for a while and you're plateauing and LG is not a benefit to you, then like, yeah, make that decision now. I totally agree with what Henry's saying. It's not worth it. But if you're like actually not sure yet, I would take a few weeks to figure it out, because I've seen plenty of students where it's just like LG is just their best section.
If you're banking on this idea that LG is going to be easy and it's going to be your best section, I think you're potentially being a little overconfident in yourself. And what I do not want is the disaster of maybe you take the first test, you take the June test with the LG, maybe the LG does not go isn't as ideal as you wanted it. Well, then you're rolling into August. It's not like studying LG is useless, but I mean, every minute you spent studying LG could have been devoted to LR at that point. You could be miles ahead on LR. This is why I think the opportunity cost is just so high for studying LG right now that it really doesn't make sense, in my opinion. Right? This is just my view. If there's not a very clear path forward for you, right? If there's not a clear path forward for a ideal, what you would consider an ideal score in logic games, being really confident at LG, it takes a lot of work, right? Being confidently at minus zero, it takes a lot of work, because you have to really be getting minus zero with time left to know that you're going to get a minus zero on the LG section on test day, or getting a minus three, right? You have to be getting a minus three with a lot of time left to be confident on test day. Whereas LR, it's like, it just doesn't seem to me that you have to have you don't have to be better than it actually takes to know what score you're probably going to get in LR. I don't know. That's all I'll say about that.
That's fair.
That's all I'll say. Yeah.
So I think that's everything for today. Just to recap, if you're in a plateau, number one, figure out if you're actually in a plateau or not, or if you just need to keep chugging along. Sometimes, by the way, if you're really like, you've exhausted all your resources, I've done everything that I possibly can, you listen to all of our advice on this podcast, and you're like, yeah, I've tried it all, or maybe you try it all in the next week, whatever it is, take some time off. Like, just dial back a little bit. That can be the best remedy for any sort of burnout or plateau or thing like that. Yeah.
Because plateauing and burnout can really coincide, and it's is it like it's just a sort of score plateau, or is it really just burnout? Because doing other things besides the LSAT makes you better at the LSAT, like truly, having time outside of studying for this test. So if it doesn't feel like enough to just give yourself like a healthier lifestyle, just know that it also benefits your score in the long run, I would say. Maybe that's our mindset minute, right? I feel like we sort of wandered into that, ticked that box, mindset minute done. I think this is a really useful topic. I hope everyone got a lot out of it. Anything else to add? I think there's a lot here for people, no matter where they are in their LSAT journey.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Keep studying.
Keep on keeping on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You got this.
Try something now. Hang in there.
Yeah, hang in there. Hang in there. You got this. The only way out is through. All right.
All right.
Peace.